Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Yesterday was a great tragedy for us all. We cannot remain indifferent.
Russia has declared a national day of mourning following the deadly Moscow concert hall attack. An ISIS affiliate has claimed responsibility. Welcome to Your World Tonight for Saturday, March 23rd. I'm Kimberly Gale. Also on the program, 18 bells toll to honor Canada's 18th Prime Minister. And emotional tributes for Brian Mulroney at Montreal's Notre Dame Basilica, packed with dignitaries, friends, and family.
He became a truly great prime minister and a world leader. But to us, he was more than that. He was a truly great father.
And later, as the Juno Awards get underway, the evolution of the music video, 4 decades after the first Video of the Year award. In Russia, the governor of Moscow walks with firefighters over the charred ruins of Crocus City Hall. Light from the gray overcast sky shines through a cavity in the partially collapsed roof. Just over a day ago, as people were taking their seats for a concert, 4 gunmen stormed the venue, shooting indiscriminately and setting fire to the building. More than 130 people were killed. Russia's president has declared Sunday a day of mourning. As Philip Lee Shanek reports, Vladimir Putin is also vowing revenge against those who planned and carried out the attack.
Mourners place flowers and toys at a makeshift memorial near the burned-out shell of the Crocus City Hall, about a 40-minute drive northwest of the Russian capital. On Friday night, 4 gunmen armed with assault rifles attacked concertgoers. Russian investigators say they used explosives and flammable liquids to set the venue on fire. Survivor Anastasia Rodionova says the gunmen gave no warnings or orders. They were just walking and gunning down everyone methodically and silent, she says. I was lucky, really lucky. I came home, my coat was covered in blood. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the suspected gunmen and 7 others have been arrested in what he calls a cynically planned act of terror, a premeditated mass killing of unarmed people. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack. Putin said suspects were trying to escape into Ukraine with the help of some people on the other side. And he vowed to punish anyone who directed, planned, or helped the terrorists in their attack against Russia, against our people. Ukraine's military intelligence denies involvement in the attack. Spokesperson Andrei Yusuf says their objective is liberating Ukrainian territory and hitting Russian military targets. Not civilians.
I don't think this is really a Ukrainian operation. That's not how.
Fawaz Jurjez is an intelligence analyst at the London School of Economics. He says U.S. intelligence recently warned of attacks on Russian targets as part of a long-standing security agreement.
The Americans basically told them a few weeks ago that extremists were planning to carry out multiple attacks on various targets, including concert halls in Moscow.
Jurjez says the attack appears in keeping with ISIS's MO. Russian authorities initially dismissed the March 7th warnings from the U.S. as provocative, but says security services neutralized a cell of extremists planning an attack on a synagogue in Moscow and days later detained the commander of an ISIS combat group. Philip Lee Shanok, CBC News, Toronto.
As Philip mentioned, ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. More specifically, U.S. officials say it was the work of a branch called ISIS-K. For more on ISIS-K, I spoke to national security reporter Ben Maku. So, Ben, most listeners will be familiar with ISIS, but who is ISIS-K?
ISIS-K stands for Islamic State Khorasan. It's an offshoot of ISIS known for a string of recent terror attacks in Turkey and Iran. It's named after an old term for the region that included parts of Iran, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan. It emerged in 2014, and it's centered in eastern Afghanistan. They've been trying to carve out a place in the country since the disastrous pullout in 2021, when U.S. forces left the country and the Taliban took power. ISIS-K is currently at war with the Taliban, and Russia is warming to the Taliban. Just last week, it was reported that the Taliban installed a military attaché in Moscow. So this very much is attack the ally of your enemy.
So that leads into my next question, which, you know, what could be ISIS-K's motive for attacking Russia?
The group is known to have opposed Russian President Vladimir Putin a lot in recent years. There are a few reasons. For one, Russia was one of the Assad regime's greatest allies during the Syrian civil war and bombed ISIS regularly. They're allies with Iran, also another ISIS enemy. So this isn't something new either. Russian authorities, by their own admission, thwarted an attack by ISIS-K in Moscow only weeks ago. It was going to be allegedly targeting a synagogue.
In his address today, Russian President Vladimir Putin made no mention of ISIS, nor did he blame Ukrainian forces. But he did say the attackers tried to escape into Ukraine. What do you make of that?
So Russia's FSB security service, is kind of the top intelligence agency in the country, said that all four terrorists behind the attack had been arrested while heading to the Ukrainian border. I think it was Bryansk. And that they had contacts in Ukraine. So far, Russian lawmakers, like former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, have started to blame Ukraine. But Ukrainian military intelligence say that Moscow's claims that the suspects fled to the Ukrainian border and that they had contacts were completely bogus. In fact, a source I spoke to in the Ukrainian military said that they already had suspected that Russia would be blaming them for this. And to add to that, today we actually saw that ISIS has now put out a longer statement claiming the attack, which is how they typically operate, even posting pictures of the attackers, blurring faces, hiding their identities.
What will you be watching for in the days ahead?
So ISIS typically attacks in twos. That being said, Russia is on alert. They're tightening security at airports, transport hubs, and across Moscow. All large-scale public events were canceled this weekend. Eventually, this could mean that, you know, Russia starts re-engaging in a bombing campaign of ISIS, which could mean that they could end up doing airstrikes in Afghanistan for the first time since the Soviet-Afghan war in the 80s.
National security reporter Ben Makou, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Canada has bid farewell to its 18th prime minister at a state funeral in Montreal. Family, dignitaries, and former prime ministers paid fond and sometimes joyful tributes to Brian Mulroney this morning. He's being remembered as one of this country's most consequential leaders. The CBC's Alison Northcott was there and tells us more.
After a procession through the streets of Montreal to the Notre-Dame Basilica, RCMP pallbearers carried Brian Mulroney's flag-draped casket into the church. Inside, his wife of more than 50 years, Mila, his children and grandchildren sat amongst dignitaries, former colleagues and friends to pay tribute to the boy from Baie-Comeau.
While my dad's Irish heritage was the rock from which his character was cut, Baie-Comeau, Quebec, his hometown, was the quarry from which it was dug.
Mulroney's daughter, Caroline, a member of Ontario's legislature, reflected on her father's legacy as a leader and his intimate final moments.
His body was tired, but his heart would not let him give us up. So Dad looked at Mum, and with what were his final words to her, he said, "I plan to. We are heartbroken by our loss. We adored him. I miss you, Daddy."
Among the guests, current and former politicians, including Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
"We all know how Brian loved to win, yet his most cherished victories were nonpartisan. Those moments where the true winner was Canada itself."
Mulroney was remembered in eulogies as a bold prime minister and world leader who negotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement, took on environmental issues like acid rain, and fought against apartheid in South Africa.
"He took risks, and by doing so became one of those rarest of leaders."
His longtime friend and former minister in his cabinet, Jean Charest, said Mulroney's work had a lasting impact.
We live in a world that he helped shape.
Mulroney's loyalty to friends and family was celebrated, too, with talk of frequent phone calls and comforting words through difficult times. Hockey great Wayne Gretzky touched on the former prime minister's sense of humor.
And then he goes, young man, remember 1993? That was a great victory for the Montreal Canadiens, right? And I said, sir, I was on the other team.
Mulroney was a lover of music.
I'm going to sing my papa's favorite song.
His granddaughter, Theodora Lapham, honored him with her voice. After the service, as the casket was carried down the aisle,
we'll meet again.
A recording of Mulroney's own voice played as guests filed out into the snow. Allison Northcott, CBC News, Montreal.
Some sunny day.
Coming up on the podcast, we'll have this story.
In their peak during the 1980s and 90s, a good music video could help turn an unknown artist into a superstar. But in the era of music streaming, are music videos still relevant?
When you have a proper music video as well, people take you more seriously, you know? They think that the projects are more serious.
I'm Magda Gebrselassie in Toronto. Ahead of this weekend's Juno Awards, artists and filmmakers make the case for why music videos still matter. That's later on Your World Tonight.
The UN Secretary General is at Egypt's border crossing with Gaza today. Antonio Guterres is once again calling for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas and for an immediate and desperately needed increase in humanitarian aid.
After so much suffering, over so many months, Palestinians in Gaza are marking Ramadan with Israeli bombs still falling, bullets still flying, artillery still pounding, and humanitarian assistance still facing obstacle upon obstacle.
Guterres says just a trickle of the aid is making it into Gaza, and many families are facing famine. The UN Security Council was supposed to consider a ceasefire resolution this morning, but the vote has now been postponed until Monday to give diplomats more time to consult. On Friday, China and Russia vetoed a similar U.S. proposal. Tensions are running high ahead of India's general election. One of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's fiercest critics has been arrested. Arvind Kejriwal, the chief minister of the capital region, New Delhi, faces multiple corruption charges. While the main opposition Congress party has had several of its bank accounts frozen. For more on what this all means heading into the world's largest general election, I spoke to freelance journalist Priyata Brajabasi in Delhi. Priyata, can you briefly tell us who is Arvind Kejriwal and how significant of an opposition leader is he?
Arvind Kejriwal is a popular opposition leader, but he's also the chief minister of Delhi, which is a very important position in the Indian context and in the context of Indian politics. He is a two-time chief minister of Delhi, and his party, the Aam Aadmi Party, has defeated Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party and other opposition parties in the country, like the Congress, to win elections in Delhi with a significant margin twice. Not only that, his party, which was once a regional party confined only to Delhi, has also made inroads into other states in India. The party now has a government in Punjab as well and has also competed in other state elections. So his party now has a national presence, and he's also the head of the Aam Aadmi Party. And it's interesting because he has been arrested on corruption charges because the fact that he's been arrested on corruption charges is interesting because the formation of his party was done on the basis of it being an alternative to corrupt parties in India.
What sort of impact will these charges against him have on the upcoming election?
His party feels that his arrest was done at this time, just a few weeks before the national elections are scheduled to start, with a very, very clear agenda, and that is Mr. Kejriwal would be unable to campaign for the upcoming elections. Now, his party is a part of a 27-party opposition alliance called the India Bloc, which was formed last year with an aim to challenge Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party, which by most surveys and by most poll predictions, it is expected to win a record third term in power. And because Kejriwal is a popular national opposition leader and is seen by many in the country as a challenger to Mr. Modi, his campaigning for the alliance and even his own party, and that's what experts also feel, could have made a huge difference in the upcoming elections. He was scheduled to be campaigning for the elections, but now his arrest has changed the situation. He's going to be in custody till at least March 28th. And it's still unclear at this point if his arrest could last longer than that.
Kejriwal isn't the only opposition to Prime Minister Narendra Modi facing problems from government agencies. The Congress party says several of its bank accounts have been frozen. What can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. In the last few months itself, many opposition parties, they've accused Mr. Modi's government of using federal agencies and federal machineries to crack down on opposition parties and on opposition leaders. Rahul Gandhi, who you mentioned, he is one of India's main opposition leaders and he's from the Congress party. And just a few days ago, he accused the government of using the Income Tax Department to completely stifle their campaign by freezing their bank accounts. He said that they are unable to fund their campaign or pay their workers or even put out ads or support their candidates, which he said is adversely impacting their election campaign and preventing a level playing field for the parties ahead of the elections. He also accused the Election Commission of India, which is an autonomous federal election agency, of purposely staying away and being silent on this matter.
Critics have accused Modi's government of using government agencies to target them ahead of the election. What is the government's response?
Time and again, the BJP government and, in fact, even Prime Minister Modi, they've been steadfast on their stance that the agencies are simply doing their jobs and they're cracking down on corruption. They say because there has been some sort of wrongdoing on the part of the opposition parties that these investigations are rightfully taking place. And the government says that they're not directly involved in any of these investigations.
Thanks, Priyata.
Thank you so much, Kimberly.
Freelance journalist Priyata Brajabasi in Delhi. The U.S. Congress has passed a major funding package, narrowly avoiding a partial government shutdown. The $1.2 trillion spending bill will keep government agencies and services funded until the end of September. It took lawmakers 6 months to pass it, slowed down by demands from Republicans for spending cuts and policy mandates. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
It is good for the country that we have reached this bipartisan deal. It wasn't easy, but tonight our persistence has been worth it. These past few months have shown yet again that when bipartisan has room to work, we can get the job done.
The bill did not include funding for direct military aid to Ukraine, Taiwan, or Israel. That is part of a separate bill that is stalled in the Republican-led House of Representatives. Few things define the pop culture of the 1980s and 90s more than music videos. They ran around the clock on channels like Much Music and MTV, and more than a few artists owed their fame, at least in part, to an eye-popping video. This weekend in Halifax, the Junos will hand out an award for Video of the Year. The music industry has changed significantly since that award was first given out 40 years ago. As Magda Gabriselassie reports, artists say videos are just as relevant.
That's a good thing.
Making music is Brady Kendall's passion, and pairing it with music videos has paid off for the artist.
Yeah, I'm just glad that the Junos care, you know. They believe that music videos still matter, so that's a good thing.
He and director Andrew DeZen are nominated for Music Video of the Year for this song, Of Woods and Seas. Kendall believes there's so much to gain from artists continuing to make music videos.
When you have a proper music video as well, people take you more seriously.
Never was it more serious than the 1980s. 90s and early 2000s. Master T was on the mic back then when music videos ran all day long on Much Music.
People would run home, you know, set their VCRs to record at 4 p.m. to make sure that they caught that the big one at that time.
But with TV channels tuning out, today music videos mainly live online. And while traditional videos still exist, visualizers are now all the rage. They can be cheaper and less complicated to make.
Everything is heading towards the short form.
Gibran Haddad is a freelance music data journalist who questions whether music videos still matter. Through Chartmetric, a data analytics tool, he compares Spotify streams of songs to the YouTube views of the videos. The streaming numbers are out far ahead, but he says videos still track some genres more than others.
Latin music and K-pop, when we look at the daily consumption of music videos on YouTube, they remain consistent throughout time.
Going back in time, music video sets have been a breeding ground for future filmmakers, from Spike Jonze to Canada's Director X.
Hopefully we can make a movie one day.
Sterling LaRose sees that in his future. In the present, he's nominated twice for Music Video of the Year. Came a long way from the... Once for directing the video for Damn Right by Snotty Nose Rez Kids. I leave all the lights on. And again for the Young Friends song, Feral Canadian Scaredy Cat. LaRose thinks music videos will continue to thrive.
The music videos will stay on YouTube. People are going to be coming back to that video for years and years and years.
And the Juno goes too.
And continue to be celebrated at award shows like this weekend's Junos. Magda Gebreselassie, CBC News, Toronto.
Those first few beats, that panning synthesizer sequence, might be all it takes to transport you right back to 1984. You might even picture it, a young Corey Hart in those iconic Ray-Ban Wayfarers, all spiky-haired and pouty-lipped, staring intensely into the camera and being dragged through a shadowy prison by fashion police. The video for Sunglasses at Night launched Corey Hart's career. The same year, Canada's music video channel Much Music was launched, where it was in high rotation. It featured a cameo by Laurie Brown, who later became a Much VJ. The music video helped Hart land a top 10 hit in the US, thanks in part to MTV. Its dystopian imagery came courtesy of director Rob Cortley. And according to Hart, it's no coincidence that it was released in 1984.
I had the concept of this 1984 George Orwellian style video where we'd be fighting against Big Brother. In this case, Big Brother was Laurie Brown, who was trying to put me in the Don jail and lock me up.
Cortley won the first ever Juno Award for Video of the Year.
And the winner for the first ever Video Juno Award is... Champagne Pictures, Rob Cortley, Corey Hart, Sunglasses at Night!
Hart would go on to have several top 40 hits in Canada and the U.S., and eventually become an inductee in Canada's Music Hall of Fame and Canada's Walk of Fame. But it's hard to deny that Sunglasses at Night remains his signature song. It remains a staple of classic rock radio and has been used in a number of TV shows, video games, and movies, including this spooky, slowed-down remix from the 2022 movie Nope. And just this year, supermodel Heidi Klum released her own version, an EDM take on the song, made with the help of Dutch DJ Tiësto. We'll leave you tonight with a little bit more of Corey Hart's original 1984 version of Sunglasses at Night. Thank you for listening to Your World Tonight. I'm Kimberly Gale.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.